Good evening.
Good evening.
This is module 12, called Mindfulness in Action, which is the same as the title of our book. This is talk 4, and the topics are first thought and appreciation. I'd like to just say a little bit more about Chapter 9, which was called Bridge of Compassion, but not too much, because first thought, best thought is a really juicy topic, and I want to put the time there. So, regarding Bridge of Compassion, it said at various points, compassion is communication rather than self-absorption. And some interesting images, action without compassion is like planting a dead tree. Compassion is also very much based upon trust in ourselves or confidence, rather than that we need to have a strategy for how to be compassionate. So the one thing we might not have said anything too much about is fear. And fear, of course, is the same as a lack of confidence. Therefore, we have to check up on ourselves. And in doing so, we shut down and actually, with too much strategy, make ourselves unavailable and too fixed. So without strategy, we can actually know when we need to be late and know when we need to, when it's best just to leave something alone and not check up on it. There was another thing that jumped out at me, which is that we don't have to feel compassion. We just have to be compassionate. Another reference to removing self. And compassion contains wisdom. So is there anything that we need to say there, that we need to elaborate on, or that someone wants to comment on?
I thought that. Go ahead. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, could you come expound on wisdom? What? Can you break wisdom up into features or elements or?
Nope. We're always going to refer to wisdom, right? Wisdom is beyond our opinions.
What's different about it from the virtues?
Virtue virya actually is more like courage or the ability to hold your place and not give in.
Did you say virtue manifests to wisdom?
It's an ingredient to make it manifest, yeah. But we aren't going to come up with a definition of wisdom that has this attribute and that attribute. Wisdom is beyond our opinions, beyond our concepts. And yet it's not beyond experience. It's experience when we are not having strategy. And yes, wisdom has compassion in it, and compassion has wisdom. We aren't going to really ever answer what happens first, the chicken or the egg.
So when you said it's a self-evident truth, deeper truth,
Well, it's not self-evident in that we generally miss it, but it is there even when we miss it, and sometimes we experience it, and it's something we can touch in on more and more because we are working on a path. Actually, it's not that nothing ever changes, that we're frozen in place. It's precisely because we aren't frozen that experience is constantly changing and moving along.
That's just one more thing. Then would that lead in, how would you connect wisdom to first breath?
First breath or first thought?
I mean first thought, maybe.
First thought, okay. Well, we're going to go right into first thought again.
There you go.
Yeah. I have one question about that.
Yeah.
So is unconditional friendliness with oneself really just the ability to be in the moment and accept it as it is?
Yeah, I think so. It's the confidence that keeps us, that says we don't have to hire a lawyer in our mind to see if we're getting it right.
Yeah, it doesn't mean getting to know yourself and all of your thoughts and madnesses in detail. It just means being who you are at the moment and accepting that and having compassion in the moment for that.
Well, somehow it does lead to actually knowing ourselves, knowing who we are. It does lead into the darker areas, but not by any form of analysis.
Right.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of like you hear, you notice those things about yourself, because when you say when you say to someone, "I like you," and you notice, oh, but they wear really awful shoes, you don't say, "Oh, now I don't like you because of your shoes you wear." It's like, oh, so, and you wear funny shoes. And it's kind of like, I notice now, hear these thoughts, and like, oh, I shouldn't have those thoughts. I'm like, no, it's okay, I just have a thought. It's not, it doesn't make me a terrible person, because it opens that space to just say, I had that thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the friendliness and acceptance of oneself, mm-hmm. which is the starting point of compassion.
Right, but yeah, you have to, I just remember I used to be like, I strike up, oh, that's a terrible thought, I don't want to have that thought, I'm not like that, that's not
right.
me.
Right, right. But is where is it coming from? It is.
Yeah, it totally is, but I didn't want that, so I was like, oh, I'm not going to get that.
Right. But there's a question, though, there in there.
Would there be sort of the universality of this for what she's saying? So in our culture, thought of shooting a deer you might judge it, but maybe in Africa where they need to eat food, they could. So is it sort of dependent upon the environment or your culture, or it's killing an animal is just, no matter what you say, it's not good, or there's no.
Well, first thought is, we're heading into first thought. But yeah, it's beyond good and bad, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's not a judgment, it's not a map to get into what our ethics ought to be.
I think along the lines of what you were saying, perhaps, is you don't need to analyze where the thought came from.
I tended to think, friendliness means you have to understand where that.
Right.
Yeah.
Along with not judging it, you don't even have to go, okay, now where did that come from? And drill back to your childhood.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying there's been a place where I've done a lot of that.
Right.
But I think the idea of absolute acceptance is that it doesn't require you to understand where it came from. And you can simply say that's where it is.
Yeah.
That's where it is. And
it's just beginning to dawn. That's really what unconditional friendliness is.
Mm-hmm.
I think in my case, it's knowing that I can, if I'm in a really terrible mood or obsessed about something, that doesn't mean I don't meditate. You know, it's like my mind is too rattled to meditate. I'm like, okay, I can sit there with that and see what I can observe and learn about that.
And then I call it a bad meditation.
You're a little
paranoid.
Yeah, I've actually had a lot of fairly valuable insights when I sat down in a terrible mood, although they weren't necessarily the standard, you know, beatific.
Well, there's nothing to be, don't expect beatific or experiences in meditation. That's really not a good idea.
It's more of a media image of the slim young woman in tight white clothing.
Oh, no. That's what we're actually encountering at this point, is the complete commercialization of meditation, marketing as a means to look better, be cool, you know, have no problems, and magnetize all the people and all the things you want in your life and magically destroy all the things you don't want. So we have to watch out for that. I mean, because it's just creeping everywhere. It's so much part of our culture now. It's just, you know, The human mind has a tremendous interest to make money and capital.
Okay.
So the next chapter is called First Thought, and somewhere into it gets to the title. Which Trungpa Rinpoche made up in 1971, called First Thought, Best Thought. And that actually happens to be a title of a book which contains 108 poems. But other than a few little snippets, we aren't going to do that. I selected a poem by someone else to use later.
We won't tell him.
She said we won't tell him.
Well, I'm sure he would not mind at all. So this chapter called First Thought actually begins with the question, what is mind? And a little, I'm jumping ahead, there's actually a sort of definition of mind. It's that which experiences a set of sense of separation. That's what it actually says in this chapter. Mind is that which experiences separation. And this calligraphy here actually says Tenki Dala, which means moon of mind. And the mind here is the mind of what happened, a kind of mind we use all the time. It's not some kind of super wisdom mind. So then it says, to find the answer, what is mind, we could ask, who is meditating? When we get no answer, we may find a gap, first thought. We have no answer, we can't find what mind is. And that's a chance for first thought to appear. The first thought eludes us because we might not like it. First thought is not necessarily what we want it to be. So then our temptation is to cover it up, to find a second thought. And especially if we're going to present it to someone else, then we really need to consult a PR person or a lawyer and make sure we have something that's presentable. But first thought is not that. And first thought presents us with incredible clarity for being present. It's the best thought because first thought is the best thought because it's unedited, because it goes beyond good and bad. It's not what it should be. It's what actually arises. And because it's what arises, it contains wisdom. It contains the ability to be fresh and present and open beyond our expectations, beyond our, enables us to go beyond what we think is even possible. But usually we miss it because we are always second guessing ourselves. So this text goes into a lot of ways in which we edit the first thought and cover it up. We start to negotiate, especially if we're with other people. We don't want to present our first thought. We're afraid of our first thought. So we start to negotiate, such as, I'll make you happy if you'll make me happy. So there's a bargaining going place somewhere there. And that's a very typical way we try to relate to people. Or the opposite, I'll make you wretched if you'll make me wretched. Or let's agree to have a fight to the death. So we're constantly getting into complications which are not first thought. So all this posturing is really unnecessary. And when we start to see that it's unnecessary, it could be that we're about to discover that we don't really exist the way we think we do. So our meditation can help us to discover that we are covering up first thought. And that could be knowing that and keep boring into it. What is first thought? Could be a way of actually opening ourselves up, going beyond the fixed view of this is myself and this is what it is, this is what's presentable, this is me, this is who I am. The book says something here quite startling. It's important to admit at the beginning that this fortress of self doesn't hold true. That's actually, it's not that we should tell ourselves that it's not true, it's that we're priming ourselves for some possibility that who we think we are is not the case. Not that we understand it, but we should be open to that possibility. And the text says it's important to admit at the beginning that that might be the case. And that there's an alternative. That alternative is first thought. Looking closely, acknowledging what is really happening. It might also help that someone else actually points it out to you. I'm not sure it does. It might depend upon whether you have any confidence that that person might be helpful or not. And that's rather an open question, which we can't quite get into. But I did want to get into something which I hope you find is a real treat, and that is Trungpa Rinpoche came up with this phrase, first thought, best thought, because he had a number of students who were poets, the chief among them being Allen Ginsberg. he found the poets gave him quite a hard time, and he had to start to figure out how was he going to jog their mind somehow or other and go beyond their feeling. And they were all actually at this time what we would call deep poets. And many of them were people who Alan had invited to Boulder. So he used this idea, first thought, test thought, as a way of inviting people to open their mind to something fresh beyond expectations. It's really a great book. It has 108 poems in it, and it has a what would we call it, an introduction by Allen Ginsberg. Yes.
Are these all poems by Cho Chang?
Yes, these 108 are poems by Cho Chang in this book. Thanks to Alan pointing it out, he pointed right into one of these poems and took a little phrase from it, and I'm going to show you a little sample, but not very much of a sample. In the middle of one of his poems, he writes...
Allen Ginsberg?
No, sorry. This is, I'm not going to read anything by Allen Ginsberg. In here, in the middle of one of his poems, he writes, "Today I rose relatively early. My thoughts are constant, like a leak in an old castle. Plop, 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 plop. Things go on. Suddenly a nasty thought. Deep sigh. Pleasant thought. Longing sigh." So, he's kind of making fun of his own thought processes here. And then, thanks to Alan for pointing out that in the middle of one of his poems is something which, if you pull it out, is almost haiku-like. It's so startling. "In the midst of jalapeno dumpling, bitten by Alice's white teeth, which are lubricated by feminine saliva." Now, if a haiku is supposed to startle your senses, I think that does it, doesn't it? "In the midst of jalapeno dumpling, bitten by Alice's white teeth, which are lubricated by feminine saliva." This is going beyond the expected. Not sensing ourselves. So it takes work, it takes courage and honesty to get the first thought and not to be satisfied with whatever replaces it. There's somewhere, and I can't quite get the source, either I saw it on a video or I was there, and I can't tell you which. But, I really can't. But Trungpa Rinpoche was talking about first thoughts. Alan was in the audience, and Alan said, "Well, when I try to find first thought, what I come up with is booger up my ass." Trungpa Rinpoche wasn't fazed by this. He said, "Well, that's not first thought. You have to find the first thought before that." Go deeper. Go deeper. Find the first thought. What's before that? What came before that? So first thought wakes us up. It can wake us up from indulgence and pleasure, indulgence and feeling that our meditation is good, that we have something enjoyable when we're getting fixed on our meditation. Or it can wake us up from pain, from feeling that we're awful and unworthy and are guilty. It can wake us up from many different things. And first thought is a way of keeping our mind fresh and open. And as Michael pointed out a few minutes ago, you can go on the web and find lots of gurus who say, I will give you meditation that leads you to great bliss and leads you to solve your problems and makes you happy. Or you could go on the web and find someone who says, we are all sinners. I can show you the path of redemption and repentance from your sin, which is the only way to salvation. You can get it either way, probably three or four different ways. Or I can solve all your political problems. Whatever. Lots of gurus around. So I'd like to read you, I think, I'm almost afraid to do this, but this is a very short poem. It woke me up before I had ever encountered Buddhism. It showed sudden awakening and second thought, self-consciousness. And it's shocking, at least it was to me. I'll put it on the website, I guess. The poem is called The Demiurge's Laugh, and it was written quite early in Robert Frost's career. It was far in the sameness of the wood. I was running with joy on the demon's trail. Though I knew what I hunted was no true God. It was just as the light was beginning to fail that I suddenly heard. All I needed to hear, it has lasted me many and many a year. The sound was behind me instead of before. A sleepy sound, but mocking half, as of one who utterly couldn't care. The demon arose from his wallow to laugh, brushing the dirt from his eye as he went. And well I knew what the demon meant. I shall not forget how his laugh rang out. I felt as a fool to have been so caught. And checked my steps to make pretense it was something among the leaves I sought, though doubtful whether he stayed to see. Thereafter, I sat me against a tree. Not that again? Did you mean anything?
Mm-hmm.
What? Should I read it again?
Yeah. What's the title on that?
The Demiurge's Laugh. I'll put it on the website.
Demiurge's Laugh?
The Demiurge's Laugh. It was far in the sameness of the wood. I was running with joy on the demon's trail. Though I knew what I hunted was no true God. It was just as the light was beginning to fail that I suddenly heard. All I needed to hear. It has lasted me many and many a year. The sound was behind me instead of before, a sleepy sound but mocking half, as of one who utterly couldn't care. The demon rose from his wallow to laugh, brushing the dirt from his eye as he went, and well I knew what the demon meant. I shall not forget how his laugh rang out. I felt as a fool to have been so caught, and checked my steps to make pretense. It was something among the leaves I sought, though doubtful whether he stayed to see. Thereafter I sat me against a tree. The first thought is not what we want to see. It's not necessarily welcome. There's a second thought, a cover up here, right?
He's looking in the leaves, like pretending he's not.
I checked my steps to make pretense of something among the leaves I saw. There's already a second thought covering it up. Though doubtful whether he stayed to see. You don't fool anyone. Thereafter, I sat me against a tree. This is a poet who some people think is about nice pastoral New Hampshire scenery. It's not. He is a poet of inner terror.
It's a boogeyman.
It's a what?
It's a boogeyman.
A boogeyman.
A shadow.
The shadow. Okay. What?
Just the terror of a dream.
Well, okay, I'm not sure what you mean by that. Do you want to say something?
Well, I'm just sharing my own thing that the aspects of that poem, you know, the responses. The primitive responses between the perception and the thought. I think it applies to our sequence of perceptions, our cognitive, at that point where the body is and the brain is accumulating all this input or accumulating input, and it hasn't yet put it into a thought. Once it gets to a thought, it's somehow constrained. And it could be as vague as the boogeyman in a dream or a nightmare. It could be positive or negative. So I'm just saying it's that primitive that Chogyam Trungpa is talking about, in the sense of he's talked about a sigh.
Okay, what?
A sigh. Didn't Chogyam mention it?
Oh, it's wrong.
He talked about a sigh and a longer sigh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what you would expect the body and the mind to be dealing with at that primitive level between the perception and the thought. So the first thought is really a primitive grunt, a primitive response. Whereas, what's his name? Alan came out with a very cerebral thing. Frost came out with a more primitive thing.
Is it primitive or is it original, startling mind?
Yeah.
You aren't going to get any comment from Frost, to be sure.
Yeah.
Primordial. Okay.
Primordial.
Yeah, that's what I don't mean.
Yeah, okay.
I was thinking about the meaning of demiurge, which is the sort of Gnostic philosophy, the belief that the creator of the world is actually an evil god, and that the good god and the creator are separate, and that the demiurge is the evil creator. That's from Gnostic Christianity.
Okay, thank you.
And that creation itself is fundamental.
Yeah, and
law,
so the material.
The demiurge is responsible for making all this happen.
Mm-hmm. The material world is bad, and so the demiurge is the creator, but he's not the good god.
Whatever. Yeah. I didn't know the meaning of the word, thank you. But I do know that Frost breaks me up beyond anything I can expect in his best poems.
Is it you are a dream first?
D-E-M-I-U-R-G-E.
I will put it up. It came from a book which was fairly old when my father got it, probably.
You know, the line that strikes me in that poem, it seems like it's related to this idea of first thought, and it talks about how surprised he was that the voice came from behind. Almost as if it was, he didn't recognize his own voice, his own inner voice.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question about the reading, about what mind means?
Sure.
And here's where I got, I felt like I was hearing two different things. I wasn't sure how to square them. Talks about how mind is, I'm not going to get the quote quite right, but that which has a need to separate itself.
Yes, that which sees like duality, that which is satisfied. Mm-hmm. Okay, in particular, there's a clue here.
Experiences.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Tibetan has many words for mind. For example, there's the word rigpa, which is in a sense primordial wisdom mind. But that's not what it says here. Semki dala, moon of mind, where mind here is exact, is sem, the mind, is what you just said. The mind that perceives duality. The mind that wants to, the mind that is dissatisfied.
Okay. Yes. Yes, and he goes on to say that when you look at first thought, you see first thought, you see mind.
Yes.
So the mind that perceives duality seems like, you know, the ordinary one.
Mm-hmm.
And the other mind, right, seems like a different kind of mind, a mind that does us good, that can perceive goodness.
Except that they turn out to be that the dualistic mind is the wisdom mind, of course. But
yeah,
because there's nothing separate.
I said that's down the road.
So basically, we're talking about thinking mind. Thinking is what basically creates duality. Thinking is what separates. I read a really, I don't know if people know, anybody knows David Bohm, who's a very interesting mathematician and person who did a lot of profound thinking, but he came up with this perception on his own without having studied Buddhism about how the thinking itself is basically what separates ourselves from nature, separates ourselves from anything, and causes that to be other.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when we say sem in this sense, in the general sense, when we encounter that term, we are referring to dualism, dualistic mind. And that's why, as only when we get to the point of realizing that there's nothing outside of mind, that we realize also there's nothing, the duality is beyond being duality. But, you know, that's like saying confusion dawns as wisdom. Right? At that point, that's when we're at that recognition, that level of recognition, which of course is great. Meanwhile, we're in the process of discovering how the mind works, and it's a rough road, you know.
So it just is what I'm trying to see if I'm understanding what he's trying to communicate is when we experience first thought and we see mind, are we seeing the thinking mind?
Oh, at first thought.
So are we seeing the mind that's not sort of not tending to the mind?
Yeah.
So on page 63, in the third paragraph down, he says, first thought is a direct experience before good, bad, and indifferent arise, which I interpret as thinking, right?
Right.
judgment,
so
yeah.
So it's still in no man's land. The area is not yet occupied by it, so that there is a, still a field of openness. So my whole issue with it's a nice phrase, first thought, best thought, that we could bring to it, but isn't what they're talking about is before thought?
Pre-thought.
Thought messes everything up.
Right.
It's like the Zen people say, don't know.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's before anything comes in and edits.
Yeah, you went on to the next paragraph. First thought of the flash is part of what you are actually what you are. That's how I didn't think you can put words to first thought as soon as you do that. Your mind is there. And if you ask yourself, who am I? There is a, and as soon as you start to, your mind is looking to try to present some picture.
But you can't find mind. Nobody has found mind. And people have been looking for mind forever. So, this is the who am I or what? What is mind? You're going to come up with the same thing. It's basically a blank. You cannot, people have said if the Buddha couldn't find mind, we can't particularly expect to find it, but we should definitely look. You know, we should be making our own efforts and, exploration to find out where, if it's possible at all, to find mind.
Mind manifests itself in the ways that we behave, speak, and think.
Of course.
Yeah.
So what do you mean?
We're talking about where is
tangible?
Mind? Where is
tangible?
Mind?
First in your head.
Well, we say here, agents say here.
Yeah. Heart.
But it still doesn't matter. You still can't find it.
Don't the scientists find it by,
CAT
scans and parts of things lighting up.
No, they find the footprints.
They find brain activity, but that's not mind. This is a very interesting point that even though you can, as you said, footprints of experience or the dynamics, we can find the dynamics of mind. We can't actually find that mind itself. So that's the key point.
It's mind that, isn't asking that question, getting away from the whole first thought thing. If we're really just experiencing things in a gut way, we wouldn't be looking for mind. It's too intellectual.
But the question is this. But the question, it's the power of the open question and not coming up with the answer. That gap is that potential to experience that.
That gap and what Jim read earlier, first thought is direct experience, but we're bad and different. We're in no man's land, it's not occupied, but this or that, there is still a field of openness. Is this referring to emptiness?
You could say that, yeah. As long as it's not a concept of emptiness, yes.
As long as it's a concept. Okay, because I can never do emptiness.
No.
First time I thought,
here it is.
Okay. One little caveat about how we interpret this. Buddha mind is not blurred or confused. Buddha mind deals accurately. It can deal with what people are thinking, can deal with how in context where Buddha mind is not blanking out or anti-intellectual. So given everything we've said, make sure you don't come up with an answer which is anti-intellectual, but simply the ability to work accurately with phenomena is itself a problem.
How can there be
Buddha
mind if there is no mind?
Well, ask yourself that.
That's a really good question. And I think that this is really this is your own koan to deal with.
Yes.
I mean,
you sold us on that a while ago. Okay.
Oh, man.
It warned me. I mean,
fire.
Is there Buddha mind then? Is Michael's just talking about it like it's Okay, well, Buddha mind is special. Not
well, we use the word Buddha nature.
Buddha nature.
Right, not Buddha.
Yeah.
So we use the word Buddha nature, yes. But it's, you won't find it as a thing.
It's not a thing.
You'll find it beyond thing.
But I think that seems like it's kind of a verbal game, though, because it seems like you could say that about a lot of other concepts, like what, you know, find beauty, find truth, you know,
yeah.
You find
mm-hmm.
examples of that. It's, I think it's like a linguistic game, you know, not that the concept is necessarily invalid, but saying you can't find mine doesn't, in my mind, to my mind, prove it.
I think all concepts are invalid.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's verbal, the verbal game, sort of categories. Doesn't invalidate the larger discussion.
No, if it stayed at that level, it would.
Well,
so we have to make sure
it
doesn't.
Beyond that.
Words are not necessarily what constitutes first thought. So, you know, he uses this term, but this term is, as I'm getting it, I'm trying to like just, I'm exploring this along. We're all exploring this together, so it's not like, you know, closer to some sense of insight or some sense of direct arising. But it's not necessarily words. It's not like some kind of little, you know, line going up on a marquee with words flowing out, you know, going along that I, you know, like, meet you at 7 o'clock tonight or whatever.
It's kind of before thought.
Yeah. And yet from it can come words which have the power to shock and wake up. From it can come words that open your mind magically. Mm-hmm. And teachers and poets are sometimes able to find that. So there is magic which is in words and which can be in words or can be in music. In other words, it's first thought finds expression in the world. It's not just a blur. No, it produces the most amazing fruit.
John?
The words, right, so the words have many connotations and we're sort of striving to understand what each other might mean. How do we, if we experience it, how do we experience it? How does a regular person on the path experience? You choose first thought or Buddha mind, Buddha nature. Experience.
You're going to have to work with it, and I'm going to have to work with it. The advice was to keep looking and seeing and going beyond. There is no formula.
Well, we talked about this summer, we worked a lot with direct perception,
yeah.
And that's a clue right there, where I don't know, I experience this when I go to Risto's, I buy odd things, and then I taste them, it's like a persimmon, you know, it's like, wow. So it's sort of that first, it's encountering something directly, beyond words. So that's not even a good example because it's concrete. So, but we still have to talk.
What about original?
Original.
Yeah, original means fresh, and it's not, you know, it's not based on just simply the concatenation of various elements that
right.
come together that
right.
you know
that
make it something happen. It's more about just an original moment, an original.
Mm-hmm.
That instant is just fundamentally original. So, I mean, I think the question is great. How do we, as ordinary people, view this? Because what Michael's getting at also, and this whole notion of poetry, you could also say music can do this. I mean, there's a kind of creativity element.
Yeah.
Behind this. But I mean, you know, so the sense is, can we do this without necessarily deciding we're artists of some kind? And I think Rinpoche was really trying to get at that. He really understood. He was an artist. He really valued the notion of the wellspring of creativity. We all have that. That's all within our fundamental experience, but we don't acknowledge it, often because we don't know how to acknowledge it. And we don't even know how to recognize it. And so he's trying to bring this to our attention. in some way. And I, you know, it's a challenge. Like
I think you can see it. It's like a Japanese garden or some landscapes or some things that you just, they stop your mind. That's another way to say it. You know, you just, it's something, there's a space there that opens up between, the duality sort of disappears in some way, and your mind opens up to that space. And things can be, it can be triggered by things in the world, by, say, music or paintings or certain experiences we can have. Yeah.
So it first felt a little bit like when we did that make remark.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
As you stand there, you don't, you're not like doing a filtering, you're just, what should happen without doing like, I'm going to plan to go here, here, here.
That is a practice of it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's a practice.
To me, I experienced, well, Beethoven, say, Eroica Symphony or the Fifth Concerto or the Fourth Concerto as 40 minutes of such astonishment that every instant of it is waking me up. And these are things I've heard 200, 300 times at least in my life. And they have the power to do that.
So is the being woken up the first time?
It's a,
the connection.
It's an astonishment of creativity. I mean, that's an extreme case, but as Michael said, our lives can actually be that way in terms of how we get out of bed and brush our teeth. That could be an astonishingly wakeful thing, yeah.
This might be going off on a tangent, but researcher Brené Brown came up with a summation that vulnerability is the birthplace of creativity.
Yeah.
So I was thinking that's interesting because vulnerability is a lot about dropping pretense. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. And the I, you know, if you have a solid I, then you can't enter that open space. So the vulnerability is dropping your edges, and then there's a brilliance there,
mm-hmm.
and that connects to something. But if you're surrounded by a thick skin of, you know, or a big crust, there's no way to make that connection.
So in the beginning, you started talking about like separateness, and so I was wondering, like separate from. The duality, separateness, but separate from what? What are you referring to?
We experience all the time separateness. That I'm here and something's happening out there. That's separateness is our normal perception.
What would be like a daily example? What would be a common example?
Oh, I'm here, I'm thinking you're out there.
Hmm?
That's not what you see.
It could be like you're watching TV and you're thinking about something else.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't matter. I am watching TV is already
on. It's the duality.
I don't
want to be one of the TV
shows. You don't.
So meditation gives us an opportunity to cut through that heavy load of thoughts, which creates and keeps us in this duality, this separation.
So what would be the opposite of like? I'm here and you're out there. What would be the other side?
Well, we can't give you an opposite. All that we can do is to point out that this is where we normally see if you don't run away.
And you just keep looking. So the practice of meditation is a way in to actually dissolve that duality.
Mm-hmm.
And the moments that... I think, you know, if you sit little bits here and there, it's great, but, you know, if you do a longer sitting period or more hours, it does wear away a lot of that.
Mm.
intense chatter, and there's points at which there's an openness that comes. So at that point where there's not such a dual, the believing in the thoughts, then there's that space. So it's a taste, but what teachers talk about is that, you know, we're creating this world of self and other, and the practice of meditation helps us to dissolve that. But nobody can tell you about it. You can only get it through your own experience and practice.
Mm-hmm. Or you have it and you don't see it. You don't recognize what's fundamentally happening already. But it is already this lack of separation, unity or integrity. And sometimes we have these heightened moments of where we can actually see that, for instance, in some kind of sense of real authentic communication between two people or something, you can see where that could come together, you could actually sense that it's beyond you and the other person, and something else that's sort of there that is, you know, embracing both, as it were. It's fundamentally just here all the time, and what we're learning about is how to get here where we never left and recognize that we're here already. I mean, this is
how to be here, just to be.
All the teachings are about recognizing what's actually here.
So, seeing if we can we take a few more minutes. Talk about the next chapter.
I think we can close, and that can go next week.
It's going to take more, and
right.
It's going to open up another huge topic, which is psychosomatic body.
Right.
And I can tell you that there's going to be a lot of people who have a lot to say about that.
Okay. So I think next week we'll take the following chapter. So read, you know, just keep reading. You know, they're short chapters, but focus on, that would be chapter 11.
Yes,
is that true?
Appreciation,
which is mindfulness of body. So these next chapters are the four foundations of mindfulness. Mindfulness of body, mindfulness of effort,
of life,
mindfulness of effort, and then mindfulness of mind. So we'll be working with those. And the point of this, we're not rushing through this book. We'll take whatever time we need. There's no point. We're not trying to accomplish, you know. We're not rushing here. So
it needs that.
Keep coming back when we tell you we've done a
question.
Another piece of nonsense. Okay. You can end it, right?